Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure with you over the next half hour. Coming up today, she was the first witness to Christ's resurrection. Why the Church is giving her added recognition. An aristocrat and a hermit. This saintly man is the patron saint of spiritual retreats. Can you guess who he is? And our favorite Vatican watcher, Joan Lewis, reveals where you might just find her if you come to Rome on pilgrimage this Jubilee Year of Mercy. On the 22nd of July each year, the Church recalls St. Mary Magdalene, the first of Christ's disciples to discover the empty tomb and to reveal the resurrection. But as of 2016, the Church no longer celebrates hers as an ordinary day of remembrance. In fact, it was on June 3, 2016, that Pope Francis signed a decree raising the celebration of the memorial of St. Mary Magdalene to the dignity of a liturgical feast. Most liturgical celebrations of saints are known formally as memorials, but feasts are reserved for important events in Christian history and for saints of particular significance, such as the 12 apostles. In a letter announcing the changes, the Secretary of the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments, Archbishop Arthur Roach, wrote, "The decision means we should reflect more deeply on the dignity of women, the new evangelization, and the greatness of the mystery of divine mercy. It is right," he said, "that the liturgical celebration of this woman has the same grade of feast given to the celebration of the apostles in the general Roman calendar, and shines a light on the special mission of this woman, who is an example and model for every woman in the Church." Archbishop Roach told Susie Hodges what makes Mary Magdalene so special.
The Holy Father has made it very clear in the decree that the congregation has issued that the decision has been taken within the current ecclesial context, where the Holy Father has been talking about, obviously, the importance of women and their role within the life of the Church. Also, in the context of new evangelization and the part that women have to play in carrying the gospel to so many people and to into places, perhaps, where men themselves do not go readily. And secondly, or thirdly, rather, within the context of this Jubilee year of mercy. So emphasizing the fact that at the time of the resurrection, when Mary of Magdala was the first one to discover that the Lord had risen. Christ showed her a very special mercy by appearing to her and also giving her this remarkable role of going to tell the other disciples that the Lord had in fact risen. And for this reason, Pope Gregory the Great, together with St. Thomas Aquinas, called her the Apostolorum Apostola, the Apostle of the Apostles. She was the one who brought that message of the resurrection to the apostles so that they could go to the ends of the earth to proclaim that Christ had risen.
Had people within the Church been requesting such a move on the part of Pope Francis?
I think that possibly, generally speaking, the Pope is always very attentive to what people are saying. As we know that he's a great listener. And so I'm sure that from certain quarters, people may very well have been talking about that. I don't know that, in fact, but that may be the case.
Given Mary Magdalene's past history as a sinner who converts. And then we read that moving scene in the Bible where she weeps as she bathes and anoints Jesus' feet. It's especially apt, isn't it, during this Jubilee Year of Mercy?
Oh, yes, it is. I mean, there's been, from the time of Gregory the Great, Pope Gregory the Great, the Mary of Magdala has been seen both as the sister of Martha, but also as the woman who wept and poured the perfumed ointment on the feet of our Lord. And the Bollandists at the time of the Second Vatican Council, those are the people who study very carefully the hagiographies of the saints, they were very clear in bringing together all that we knew from the Gospel about this woman, and all three of them now appear in this feast of Mary of Magdala.
She was, as you already pointed out, the first witness to Christ's resurrection. But in a broader sense, what do you feel is the special appeal of this woman, and how can she serve as a role model for women in the church nowadays?
Well, women have a very special place within the role of the family, the role of society in general, because of their natural ability for compassion apart from anything else. And we see that how she was led in the garden to Christ through this anxiety, through this compassion, through this great love that she had for him, that was able to seek him beyond. You know, what have you, she says to the angel, what have they done? You know, where have they taken his body? What have they done with his body? And it's then that Christ appears to her and calls her by name, Mary, and she recognizes him immediately. Rabuni, teacher, master, she says to him. And he says, okay, don't cling to me, because now this is a moment of faith. This is a moment for the whole church to recognize that you don't cling to what is physical, materialistic. You now have to act in faith to proclaim the resurrection, that I am among you always, and I shall be with all of you throughout the rest of time.
Archbishop Arthur Roche, the Secretary of the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments. As you heard at the start, he was a nobleman, hermit, priest, and theologian, all wrapped into one. The Church celebrates his feast day on July 31st each year. It's St. Ignatius Loyola, the patron saint of spiritual retreats and founder of the Jesuit order. He's renowned, among other things, for his spiritual exercises, as we hear in this program by Jill Bevilacqua.
Take, O Lord, and receive all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will, all that I have and possess. Thou hast given all to me. To thee, O Lord, I return it. All is thine. Dispose of it according to thy will. Give me thy love and thy grace, for this is enough for me.
This prayer of self-offering to God is taken from the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. Called the greatest of all books of instruction, it has been for centuries the blueprint for every retreat worthy of the name.
Its author, Iñigo López de Rejalde, is known to us as Ignatius Loyola, founder of the Society of Jesus. Ignatius was born in 1491 in the castle of Loyola in the Basque country of northern Spain. Though his family were noble, they were not rich, and Ignatius, as the youngest of 13 children, had to make his own way in the world.
At about 16, he was taken into the household of a kinsman who was treasurer of the Kingdom of Castile. His father hoped he would become a cleric, but Ignatius enjoyed court life with all the gambling, dueling, and romances with women that went along with it.
Small, with reddish hair, he was, we are told, a lively and trim young man, very fond of court dress and good living. Ignatius confirmed this himself later when he wrote in his autobiography, "Up to my 26th year, I was entirely given up to the vanities of the world and felt a keen and empty craving to excel."
But the future of Ignatius Loyola did not lie in a courtly career. The downfall and death of his patron left him suddenly unemployed. The widow gave him money and two horses and sent him off to the Duke of Nayera, who took Ignatius into his service as a gentleman. This office included taking up arms when necessary, something which the young man enjoyed. Like Francis of Assisi, he began to dream of covering himself with glory on the battlefield.
So it was that on a fine May morning in the year 1521, Ignatius was occupied in defending a breach in the castle wall at Pamplona against French invaders. A cannonball hit him, shattering his right leg and wounding the left one. Ignatius was invalided home. The dreams of glory faded.
The period of inactivity which followed was to be the most decisive time of his life. The leg was twice set wrongly, and as Ignatius wanted to continue to wear the fashionable high boots worn by officers, he had it broken again and reset, enduring the excruciating pain without complaint.
Convalescence would be long, so Ignatius asked for some romances to read to help pass the time. But there were none available, so he was given A Life of Christ by a Carthusian and a collection of Lives of the Saints.
Ignatius picked up the books with some distaste, but before long he was engrossed. Not only did he enjoy what he was reading, but he read and reread several times. A new ambition was taking hold of him. He couldn't fight in a temporal army anymore. Well, then he would join the Knights of God and become a soldier of Christ.
The qualities of Ignatius Loyola, which distinguished him as a temporal soldier, a strong sense of duty and obedience and high-minded chivalry, were exactly fitted to the new life he would soon undertake. A modern Jesuit, Father Karl Rahner, also emphasizes the background of the first Jesuit. Ignatius kept, all his life, an aristocratic sense of form, order and loyalty, along with a practical, realistic grasp of problems, people and principles, which reflect both the nobility of his background and the fact that it was provincial nobility, close to the realities of life.
As soon as he could walk, Ignatius set off for the shrine of the Black Virgin at Montserrat. He made a general confession, and then, laying his sword and dagger on the altar, watched all night in vigil, like the knights of old. He gave away his fine clothes and dressed in a rough pilgrim's tunic, and then came down from the mountain. He found a cave in the nearby village of Manresa, and there he lived for a year as a penitent, practicing severe penances.
Later, Ignatius was to realize that excessive physical mortification was a mistake, as he reveals in his letter to Francis Borgia, a couple of years after Borgia had become a Jesuit.
If the body is ailing, the soul cannot properly function. We ought to love and cherish the body, insofar as it is obedient and helpful to the soul. For with such obedience and assistance, the soul can the better dispose itself to serve and praise our Creator and Lord. With regard to the castigation of the body, I would be for avoiding altogether any form of it that could cause a single drop of blood to appear. Instead of seeking to shed our blood, it is much better to seek directly the Lord of us all and his holy gifts, such as tears for our sins, an intensification of our faith, hope and charity, joy in God and spiritual peace.
Ignatius ruined his own health that year, but on the positive side, it was a year of self-discovery. And it was during that year that he meditated deeply on two themes, the kingdom of God and the two standards, that of Christ and that of Satan. What he found useful for his own spiritual life he wrote down in the hope that it might help others. The notes he made became the basis of the spiritual exercises. He discovered then, as he wrote later in the introduction to his book, that
as the body can be exercised by going, walking and running, so the will of man can be trained by exercises to find the will of God.
In 1523, Ignatius went on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Then he went back to school to learn basic grammar and Latin, and on to university, first in Spain, then in Paris. Here he met the men who were to be his first recruits. To his two roommates, one of whom was named Francis Xavier, Ignatius gave a copy of his spiritual exercises. The three men pinned a picture of Jesus on the door of their room. Other recruits came, and on the Feast of the Assumption, 1534, Ignatius and six others met in a chapel in Montmartre and made a vow, the substance of which was to devote themselves to the welfare of their neighbour while living a life of strict poverty in imitation of Christ.
First, they would go on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. If that proved impossible, they would offer their services to the Pope to use as he thought best. Although the Society of Jesus was not formed until 1539 and blessed with the papal bull in 1540, The foundations were laid on that August day in 1534. Each of the companions of Ignatius tried out the spiritual exercises, learning to be, as he himself says,
like a corpse which can be turned this way and that, or a rod that follows every impulse, or a ball of wax that might be moulded in any form.
This availability was to be one of the distinguishing characteristics of the Jesuits.
Ignatius was neither writer nor scholar, a man with few ideas but great practical gifts and a natural ruler of men. He composed his exercises to help others. They were not intended as a literary work, but as a solid working tool for those who wished to enter into the serious work of their salvation. He gave specific guidelines, both for those doing the exercises and for those giving them.
The one who is giving instruction in the method and procedure of meditation or contemplation should be explicit in stating the subject matter for the contemplation or meditation. He should limit his discourse to a brief summary statement of its principal points, for then the one who is making the contemplation, by reviewing the true essentials of the subject and by personal reflection and reasoning, may find something that will make it a little more meaningful for him or touch him more deeply. Anyone making the exercises will benefit greatly if he enters into them with great courage and generosity with his Creator and Lord, offering him his entire will, so that his divine majesty may make use of his person and all that he possesses in accordance with his most holy will.
As the first general of the order, Ignatius found himself constantly obliged to write. His headquarters for directing the society consisted in three cells in a Roman slum. He worked at a wooden trestle table and slept on a portable cot. With no time to sit and eat, he nourished himself with chestnuts, bread and water. All day long he read reports, answered letters, and issued precise directives to his followers. He kept in touch with all of them, loved them dearly, and often thought of those who were far away, like Xavier, whom he'd sent to India on the insistence of the King of Portugal. He cared for the younger members too, often sending fruit to the novices' table, even peeling it for them himself.
For himself, Ignatius asked nothing, neither honours, nor rest, nor reward. Even his death was muted. When he felt the end was near, he asked his secretary to get the Pope's blessing for him. "I'm busy just now," was the answer. The man went next day, but when he got back, Ignatius was dead. It was 1556.
Behind him, Ignatius left, spread over the major cities of Europe and a growing number in Asia, his life work, the Society of Jesus, over 1,000 strong, dedicated to the greater glory of God. Characteristic of the spirituality of Ignatius is his note in the Contemplation to Attain Divine Love, in which he thanks God for his gifts and offers himself.
The first point is to call to mind the benefits that I have received from creation, redemption, and the particular gifts I have received. I will ponder with great affection how much God our Lord has done for me, and how many of his graces he has given me. I will likewise consider how much the same Lord wishes to give himself to me, insofar as he can, according to his divine decrees. I will then reflect within myself, and consider that I, for my part, with great reason and justice, should offer and give to his divine majesty all that I possess and myself with it, as one who makes an offering with deep affection, saying, "Take, O Lord, and receive all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will. All that I have and possess, thou hast given all to me. To thee, O Lord, I return it. All is thine. Dispose of it according to thy will. Give me thy love and thy grace, for this is enough for me."
And that was a program written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. For more than 30 years, Joan Lewis has been Rome's resident Vatican watcher, and her new book, A Holy Year in Rome, The Complete Pilgrim's Guide for the Jubilee of Mercy, gives many a tip on the how-tos and where-to-goes for the Catholic Jubilee traveler. Today, Joan takes us on a quick tour outside of Rome and back again, and even reveals where we might be lucky enough to catch her attending Mass. In your book, you also look at Castel Gandolfo, which is, of course, well, in the past, it's been known as the summer papal residence. However, Pope Francis has sort of eschewed that title, preferring the Vatican, because he seems to be working in the summer here in the Vatican.
He has said himself in answer to questions and interviews that he just really doesn't know how to take a vacation. He's so used to working.
But that
it doesn't mean he can't.
Yeah. It's a bit of a disappointment for the people of Castel Gandolfo,
heavens,
of course, for people who don't know, it is a lakeside village up in the hills outside of Rome. It's about 40 minutes from downtown Rome. It is spectacular. You've been there, I think,
several times. The grounds are gorgeous. Actually, territory-wise, it is bigger than Vatican City that we are just, you know, a couple blocks from. The Vatican City State, lush, beautiful gardens, a palace, which is buildings which actually house also two of the famous Vatican telescopes. The ones that do the real astronomical work today are in Tucson, Arizona. But a wonderful building. And I do remember John Paul and Benedict said that what they liked about it, and Saverio Petrillo, who for years, 55 years, I think, was master of the papal villas out there. Everybody always said it's so much more homey to be there. Yeah, it's a beautiful building, but it's a lot smaller than the buildings, obviously, in Vatican City here. You just do kind of feel like you're in your country home. Many of the rooms overlook the lake. It's a beautiful little town.
It's very quiet. And also you've got the farm. There's a Vatican farm.
And that's about a third of the property. This is a farm that makes, they have their own olive oil. They have their butter, their milk, their yogurt. And there's a shipment delivered of many of these products every morning, about 6, to the Vatican here in Rome. But all these fresh things put on the Pope's table. And it's so funny because there wouldn't be any reason why Pope Francis couldn't work there. And actually, the reason I wrote about it, I probably wouldn't have if people couldn't go there, because why give them an hors d'oeuvre and then they can't have the meal? But there are trips now, and it's in my book, How to Do It, and it's also on the Vatican website, vatican.va. Go to the section on the Vatican Museums, and you will find information on these tours. Because now there's tours, the shortest visit, but like an hour and a half, of the Vatican Museums. You're then brought into the Vatican Gardens, which is a joy in itself. Then you walk your way over to the train station and take a train out to Castel Gandolfo, and there buses, minibuses, bring you up to the palace and to the gardens. It's just a delightful experience, and so that's why I wrote about it, and that's why I wrote about Vatican City, because people can visit it. Delightful, you and I know, we've strolled through the gardens and the beautiful Casina Pio Quarto, and just the history of the buildings, the fountains, the gardens. And the gardens are two different styles. There's a very formal, beautifully taken care of, sculpted gardens. And then there's gardens where it's like, wow, I don't think a gardener's been here in 20 years. the very informal, and they're allowed to be that way. That's what they are.
But in your book, you give tips and pointers on how to, you know, for example, go visit the Scavi under St. Peter's Basilica, where St. Peter is believed to be buried. You give some ideas on visiting the Vatican Museums, how to book tickets to the audience, that sort of thing. So a very useful guidebook.
What I did in that particular section, the tips for tourists, I have kind of actually two sections on tips, but I took the actual official page from vaticanstate.va with all the information, the telephone numbers, the emails, etc. And then I just added my own tip from Joan. You know, here's a shortcut, or here's a better way, or don't think of getting into St. Peter's Basilica unless your shoulders and knees are covered. And that's men and women. So the useful things, why come all the way to Rome and then you can't get in the basilica because you're not dressed correctly, you know. So I even do give the names of the all the embassy names, addresses, phone numbers of all the embassies of English-speaking, you know. So, I mean, the United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Great Britain, et cetera. So
now, speaking of the English-speaking community and the embassies here, you do also talk about your own American parish here in Rome. It's a
Church
it's
of Santa Susanna.
Parish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Since January of 1922, the church has been entrusted to the Paulist Fathers, and the church itself is owned by the Cistercian Order, and there is a small group of nuns that live they're cloistered, so they live in a grated area, if you will, behind the actual church itself. And so, gosh, I've been a member of Santa Susanna, I think, almost all my 30-some years in Rome. John Paul said Mass there. We have three Masses on weekends. And right now, because of some restoration being done on the church, the physical building is closed, so Masses are elsewhere, and I believe I give that in the book. But I know that when John Paul said Mass, the church had been closed for a few years again for restoration, a 500-year-old ceiling about to collapse or something. So closed for several years, and he came and celebrated Mass. And he was telling the Cistercian nuns how valuable the ministry of the Paulist is. He said their main charism is bringing people back into the church who may have fallen away. Mm. So it's a very active parish.
We've got some of your fans listening to this program. Where can they perhaps see you on a Sunday morning Mass with the Paulist Fathers?
Paulist Fathers. I usually help out on Saturdays. Our Mass now, if at 5:45, is in a chapel at St. Mary, Santa Maria degli Angeli, that beautiful big basilica on Piazza Repubblica. And if not, it would be a Sunday morning 10 o'clock Mass at San Camillo, Camillo di Lellis, a very beautiful church. And so that's where I will be a lector. And how many people have come up to me because they know my voice? Well, it's funny. I mean, I've lived with this voice all my life. It's nothing special
nothing
to
new.
Me.
Nothing new.
But, yeah, exactly. So they recognize it from radio and TV. And then anybody in Rome wanting to get the book, it is available at the Vatican Bookstore and at the Pauline Multimedia, other stores.
People order it on Amazon or online somewhere?
I know Amazon.com had it. I can't speak at this moment, and I should be able to, of Amazon.the UK. Sophia Institute Press is they're the publishers, and you go online to them. And the Amazon had a pre-order for the book, and Amazon ran out, and they had to order more books. So that's always a good sign for
always
a book.
Good news.
Yeah, exactly. But what I try to do in the book, people tell me I've achieved it, is it's as if you and I are walking through the Vatican Gardens, through a holy door, into some other church in Rome, because I do look. There's a chapter called "In If You Have Time," and very short looks at other magnificent churches in Rome. But it's as if I'm physically walking with you, and we're talking. And I want to be your friend. And people said, people write me, not even knowing this was my intention, "Oh, Joan, it's just like being with you at St. Peter's or whatever." So I have achieved that, you know.
Well, congratulations, yeah. Joan. It's a real treat to see you here at the radio and to be able to talk about this book that you've put a lot of heart
and
experience
and passion
into. Thanks so much. And a warm thanks there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief and co-host of Joan Knows on Vatican Radio.
I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.